Mark 5 is where we'll be looking. As I mentioned last week, the section here that we began in Mark 4, and it goes all the way through Mark 5, is just an incredible display of Jesus' power. As Mark shows four events that clearly display Jesus' power, and not just any power, but clearly display that Jesus wields and has power that only belongs to God. And Mark is showing by Christ's deeds that Jesus is God. And that really, just to remind us of that single straightforward point this morning, even as we begin reading in Mark 5, and in beginning in verse 1, and it's a little bit longer section this morning, we're going to read down to verse 20. It says, "And they came over unto the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him, and cried with a loud voice, and said, What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee, or I implore thee by God, that thou torment me not. For he said unto him, Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And he asked him, What is thy name? And he answered, saying, My name is Legion, for we are many. And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country. Now there was nigh unto the mountains a great herd of swine feeding. And all the devils besought him, saying, Send us into the swine, that we may enter into them. And forthwith Jesus gave them leave, and the unclean spirits went out, and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violently down a steep place into the sea. They were about 2,000, and were choked in the sea. And they that fed the swine fled, and told it in the city and in the country. And they went out to see what it was that was done. And they come to Jesus and see him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And they that saw it told them how it befell to him that it was possessed with the devil, and also concerning the swine. And they began to pray him to depart out of their coast. And when he was come into the ship, he that had been possessed with the devil prayed him that he might be with him. Howbeit Jesus suffered him not, but saith unto him, Go home to your friends, and tell them how great things the Lord has done for thee, and hath had compassion on thee. And he departed, and began to publish in Decapolis how great things Jesus had done for him. And all men did marvel." If you remember, a few months ago in April, we saw the account of Jesus casting a demon out of a man in the synagogue in Capernaum. And if you remember from then, we talked a little bit about what demons are. Demons are angels created by God, which rebelled against God. As a result of their rebellion, they were cast out of their heavenly service and condemned to eternal destruction. Though they have already been condemned, the demons' punishment has not yet been enacted. So in the meantime, Satan and his rebellious angels are somewhat out on bail. They are roaming about the earth, seething with hatred for God and man. And these vicious creatures are bent on man's destruction, both physically and, most importantly, eternally. As part of their tyranny and their domination and their bent to destruction, demons are able to inhabit physical bodies. They are able to enter into a person and essentially take control of that person's life and body. Now, this may sound like something out of Hollywood, but I can assure you, as we've seen here and other places, it is biblical fact. Now, the details of what this looked like probably don't bear much resemblance to what Hollywood might show. The demon-possessed aren't going to levitate. Their heads aren't going to spin around. They're probably not going to speak in a deep, devilish-sounding voice. Typically, in fact, biblically, what we usually see in scriptures, the demon-possessed are them crying out in agony, of doing themselves severe harm. We see an example of them throwing themselves in the fire. We see here them cutting themselves. And we also see demon possession showing itself through those that speak as oracles and prophets to promote false worship or false teachings. And in all of this, we have to remember Satan is a liar. He specializes in deception. And so that really is going to be a primary tool as in his arsenal in dealing with individuals. And demon possession is a real and terrifying event that furthers the diabolical design of bringing maximum suffering on mankind and of opposing the salvation of men. But when we think about this, and I don't want to be overly sensational by any means. We're not going to spend much time more on this particular idea of it. But as we think about it, we do need to avoid the errors of two extremes. And both of these are common in America right now. The first error is just to assume that demons are not active at all today, or that they cannot take control of an individual life. Now that is an error. There, we need to avoid that mistake, but we must be careful not to go to the other end that we also see somewhat common in America, is to see demon in every bad circumstance, in every sin, or in every person enslaved to sin. So while demon possession is a real thing, we also don't need to imagine that we are surrounded by demon possessed people, or that every bad thing that happens to us is the result of a demon inhabiting that particular thing. So when your car stops working, it's not necessarily that there's a demon in the engine. You meet somebody that is opposed to the gospel, it doesn't mean necessarily that they are demon possessed. We have ample wickedness in our own flesh. We don't need a whole bunch of outside help. But we also don't need to, we do not need to discount the spiritual reality that is there. And the reality is we are in a spiritual warfare. Every believer is in spiritual warfare. And we need to be aware of this. And so even today, as we come to Mark chapter 5, this passage really contains the Bible's most graphic, lengthy description of demon possession. And so if we're going to rightly understand what's happening in this passage, we do need to understand some of these basic facts about demons. But as we will see in this account, these truths should not make the believer fearful. These are powerful spiritual beings, and they absolutely are our enemies. But they can never hinder or stop the working of God. They are rebellious creatures, but they are creatures nonetheless. And as we'll see a vivid example of today, as creatures, they must always give way to the will of the Creator. And so this account before us, beginning in Mark 5 verse 1, this account happens immediately after the events in Mark chapter 4. So as Jesus left Capernaum, if you remember from last week, kind of on the northwest edge of the Sea of Galilee, they were cutting diagonally across the Sea of Galilee, a trip of about 11 miles if they went straight across. On the way across, a huge storm sprang up, terrifying the disciples, nearly sinking the boat. Jesus is asleep during the storm. The disciples wake him up in fear. He speaks. He commands the storm. The wind and the waves immediately stop. A calm springs up. The disciples marvel in fear at Christ as they say, "What manner of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" And then Mark 5 picks up with now they've landed on the other shore. They have traveled across, and probably, and we don't know for certain, but they left Capernaum sometime in the evening. They endured the storm in the night, so they probably reached the Gadarene shore sometime very early in the morning. And let me point out one thing before I even get into this. Go to Mark 5, look at verse 21. I want you to have this in your mind as we're looking at all of the rest of what happens from here. Mark 5, verse 21. This is after all of the events there in the region of the Gadarenes. And it has all taken place apparently in the space of a day, possibly within a space of a few hours. It says, Mark 5:21, when Jesus was passed over again by ship unto the other side, much people gathered unto him, and he was near unto the sea. So what he shows us here in Mark is that Christ that evening left Capernaum, traveled down to the region of the Gadarenes. The account that we're looking at here in Mark 5, the healing of the demon-possessed man happens, and he goes right back up to Capernaum. It seems as if, and I think I can say this, it certainly fits with Christ's character, but it seems as if he has gone to this region just for this man. For this single miracle. And then he goes right back to Capernaum. Now we know from John 4:4, when Jesus traveled through Samaria, the Bible tells us he must needs go through Samaria. There was a pressing burden for him to go through there. There was a purpose and a reason for him to take a different journey. And we know Jesus went through Samaria to meet the woman at the well so that she and many other Samaritans would believe on him and be saved. And apparently Jesus travels across the sea to deliver this one man. Even though, as we already read, and we'll see again, he was rejected apparently by all of the rest of the people in that region. He goes to this one man. Such compassion. It's amazing. This compassion that drove Jesus. And I think we see in this a picture, a small picture of the greater work that Jesus did. As it came to us who were in desperate need. And it really made special trip for us, knowing that the vast majority of mankind would reject him. And so Christ left Capernaum. He travels to the southeast shore of the Sea of Galilee. He lands near the hills on the outskirts of town. And he steps out onto the land and he's immediately confronted by a man who lived in the tombs. This man was demon-possessed, or as Mark says in Mark 5:2, that he had a man of an unclean spirit. I think there's something here I need to point out that's very significant. Mark identifies this man as controlled by an unclean spirit living in an unclean place. Numbers 19 tells us that anyone who comes in contact with a dead body or a grave is unclean for 7 days. So during those 7 days, that one that has come in contact with the tomb cannot come into the temple, cannot offer sacrifice, cannot join in the regular acts of worship in Israel. And for that 7 days, the one that is unclean is separated from God and separated from approaching God, separated from the worship of God. And this man, by the spirit that is controlling him and by where he is doing, by his actions and the filth that is surrounding him, he is separated from God's presence. And so as we're seeing this, I think Mark is making a point here that we can't miss. It's not just he's rescuing a man from demon possession. Christ is coming to a man that is completely, very visibly, clearly separated from God and is restoring that man into peace and fellowship with God. And so he comes to this man. And Mark gives us a pretty detailed description of this man's plight. He was, as I've already said, he had his dwelling among the tombs. Now, when you read that, don't think a modern American cemetery. There was not nice lawns with evenly spaced headstones and lots of flowers here and there and some really nice big old trees and it wasn't really anything like that. Imagine instead a hillside dotted with many small caves. Some of them were natural. Some of them had been carved out by families. And the bodies would be placed inside those caves. And many times they would be sealed up with stones. But the tombs was just simply caves in the hillside. This demon-possessed man was probably living in one of these cave tombs. And that's where he spent all of his time, here in and amongst the tombs. And he was a man that was, because of his demon possession, because of the madness that ensued, he was a danger to himself and all around him. So the townspeople, verse 4 tells us that he had often been bound with fetters and chains. The townspeople had at previous times captured this man. They had attempted to chain him up. But because of the demon possessing him, this man had supernatural strength. And he's able to break apart the chains and the shackles that were supposed to hold him. It tells us that neither could any man tame him. The man was crazed beyond anyone's control. And Mark tells us in verse 5, he was always night and day was in the mountains and in the tombs crying and cutting himself with stones. Apparently this man is just always wandering, always, you know, going in and among and around and shrieking and screaming in his agony. He's finding sharp stones and cutting himself in his misery. And Mark is drawing a vivid picture here. And I don't want to, my desire this morning is not to be sensational, but I want us to, I hope you have an image of what this man's going through. Of what this man is, what his condition is like. This man is in intense, deep, spiritual and physical agony. His pain is palpable. It's visible to anybody who comes within hearing distance of the man. And no matter what help the townspeople had tried to give, and I imagine, and this is my imagination, but I imagine that family and friends at first were trying to help him. They didn't just immediately say, "Oh, he's weird. Let's chase him out into the mountains." I think they originally tried to help him. But nothing they did was to any avail. And so they were left with no choice but to attempt to confine him and to try to keep him from harming himself and others. And even that failed. And so even in the end, this tortured man is left in a completely hopeless, miserable condition. And it tells us that when Jesus landed, this man saw him. Verse 6, he says, when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and he worshiped him. The man recognized Jesus immediately. The demons in the man recognized Jesus. And they ran immediately to Jesus. They drove this man to Jesus' feet and they fell down before him. And I know the King James says he worshiped Jesus, but don't understand that in the same sense that we talk about worship today. They certainly did not begin singing worship songs to him. They did not begin to adore him and to praise him. They came and the idea of worship as it's used here is that of a submission to a more powerful ruler. It is an act of respect given to one who is known and has proven himself to be greater. So this is not a religious devotion or a loving submission to the gracious rule of his Lord. This is a rebel slave bowing helplessly before his master. It is a conquered king bowing before his conqueror. This demon is coming and he is acknowledging he has no choice but to acknowledge that this Jesus is greater. And so he falls down before Jesus' feet. And he cries out, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God?" Well, again, we saw this in April. The demons and the man in the synagogue knew who Jesus was. They acknowledged him as God and as Messiah. Here this demon declares that Jesus is God the Son. And every time we see an instance of these demons, of any demon-possessed individual coming in the presence of Christ, they have no choice, it seems, but to acknowledge who He is, acknowledge His deity. They dare not deny it. And even though they are in utter rebellion against Him, they have to acknowledge that He is God. And then in that acknowledgement, He makes what may seem a bit of a strange request. He says, I adjure thee, or I plead with you by God that you torment me not. This demon begged Jesus to not torment him. And the reason he said this is because Jesus had said, come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. Christ had already commanded this demon to come out, and the demon pled with Christ not to torment him. He did not want to be driven out. He certainly, as we'll see later in this, he did not want to be sent into basically imprisonment. He did not want Christ to bring any punishment on him. Really, what he's saying, ultimately, and again we'll see this, is he's wanting to be left alone. I think really in the end, that's what these demons are asking, is that they'll just simply leave them alone. They don't want to be sent out of the man. They don't want Jesus there just by his presence afflicting them and disturbing them. They just want to be left alone. And we'll see this in the end of the story too, not from the demons, but from the townspeople. I mean, this really, the one bound in sin often just thinks the best thing is to be left alone. I mean, how many times have we heard something of that sort in our culture? You know, that's fine for you. Just, this is fine for me. Or, you know, you have yours, I have mine. You keep yours and I'll do what I want to do. Or, and now it's getting to the point of the expectation that we affirm and rejoice in whatever their wickedness. But this idea of just leave me alone. Sure, you want to believe in Jesus? Great. You want to have church? Great. Keep church in church. Don't bring it to work. Don't bring it to the neighborhood. Just keep church in church. Leave me alone. That's what this demon is pleading. Just leave me alone. Don't do anything to me. Don't send me out. Don't torture me. Just leave me alone. And the wicked imagine, and this is the twisted logic of the one that is bound and enslaved in sin. The wicked imagine that Jesus has come to torture them. They imagine that Jesus' presence is the worst thing. Because in the twisted thinking there, the sin is the great thing. The sin is the wonderful thing. And really, we have a massive case of spiritual Stockholm syndrome. You know what Stockholm syndrome is when somebody is kidnapped and held in bondage, and after a while they begin to fall in love with their captor. That's what we're talking about, is that the sin has so enslaved us that we imagine it is a wonderful thing, and we see Christ coming to set us free. And we imagine that He is coming to torment us. We think He's coming to make our life miserable, when in reality He's coming to deliver us, to bring us into that which is really joyous, really wonderful. And so we see these demons here crying to be left alone, a cry of rebellion, not a cry of submission, but cry asking to be allowed to continue in their miserable ways, and to be allowed to continue to afflict this poor man. And these demons, they knew Jesus is God, but they were still rebels against His rule. And then Jesus asked this man a question. He asked the demons a question. In verse 9, He asked him, what is thy name? And the demon answers, my name is Legion, for we are many. Today that demon might answer, my name is Regiment, for we are many. A legion was a body of troops in the Roman army that was made up between 6,000 and 12,000 soldiers. So to see the full extent of this man's misery, He is possessed and under the domination, not of one or two demons, but of thousands of demons. I mean, this is as bad as it seems it could ever get. We see this as well in this. And I don't want you to miss this. We see the power of God in Jesus. We see the power of Jesus as God. Because thousands of demons are groveling at Jesus' feet. Do you see that? We see the man in his misery, and we should, but we must not miss the power. Thousands of demons are bowing before him. And they are not even kneeling before Jesus while he's seated on a celestial throne, exercising all of his power with his glory fully unveiled. They are kneeling before him while he is wrapped in humanity. They are kneeling before him in his humility, having set aside his power and his rights as God. These thousands of demons are groveling before the humbled Savior. Not yet, at that time, the conquering king. Do you see the awesome power here? How great is our God? How awesome is his majesty, so that in his lowliest form, it is so magnificent that a great brigade of demons cowers at his feet. And the demons then, verse 10, beg Jesus to not send them out of the country. In Luke chapter 8, we have the same account. In fact, all three of the synoptic gospels have this account. But Luke 8 tells us they begged him not to command them to go out into the abyss. What the demons are not asking to be allowed to stay in that region of the world. They're not saying we like the view here we have by the Sea of Galilee. We like the people and the community. They're saying don't send us into prison. Don't send us off into imprisonment. You know, the Bible tells us that there are currently some demons being held in a place that we might call the abyss. That's maybe a common word for it. They are imprisoned. And we don't know exactly why, but these demons, there are a number of demons that are held in imprisonment right now. They're not free as many others are, but they're held in imprisonment until the last days, and I won't delve into it from there, but they are held in imprisonment, and these demons were fearful that Jesus was going to throw them into that imprisonment. They're pleading with him not to send them away. And again, the power of Christ on display here. He stands before them as their judge. He stands before them in his humility, and they recognize he has every authority to dispose of them as he wills. And if he decrees it, they have no choice but to go off into imprisonment where they will remain. Instead, they beg to be sent into a nearby herd of pigs. And this is a little bit of speculation, but I think there's some of this, the driving home the desperation of these demons. To the Jewish mindset, swine were unclean animals. I mean, this is about the worst possible place you could go, is go live among the swine. You remember the story of the prodigal son. He got to the bottom. When he got to the very, very bottom, he was keeping pigs. He was slopping the hogs, and that was as low as it got in the Jewish mindset. And these demons are pleading to be driven into the herd of swine. Anywhere. Send us even to the pigs. Just don't send us into prison. And so they're begging to be sent into this. And Jesus commands them to leave the man. He gave them permission to enter into this herd of 2,000 pigs. And again, they're little detail there that confirms the number of demons. There's at least 2,000 demons being cast out of this man. I mean, incredible. Incredible. And again, I want to stop. Let me pause here before we go anywhere else. And look at what's just happened. Jesus has sailed across the Sea of Galilee. On reaching its southeast shore, he's been confronted by a man possessed by thousands of demons. And these demons are powerful spiritual creatures who exist in a constant state of hate-filled rebellion against God. And when these demons see Jesus, who is God, they do not run on him and attempt to tear him to pieces. They do not stand in front of him and dare him to do his worst. This regiment of mighty spiritual beings falls down in front of the one who is despised and rejected of men. They fall down in front of Jesus and acknowledge he is God. He rules over them and he has all power to do all that he will with them. At his command, and only at his command, not a moment before, the demons flee, grateful to escape any harsher punishment. To put this very succinctly, what Mark is showing us is that Jesus is God and all creation must acknowledge that fact. Jesus is God and all rebels must do all that he decrees. Jesus is God and even hordes of demons bow down before him. In their rebellion, they have no choice but to obey him. What power is that? What an incredible might and majesty that we see here. And Christ has delivered this man. He sends the demons off into the herd of pigs. The herd of pigs run off the cliff and are never heard from again. The keepers of the pigs run off to town to tell everyone what has happened. And the man, what a great change. What a great change. Verse 15. They saw him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind. He is no longer running naked through the tomb, shrieking in pain and torment. He is no longer afflicting himself and others. He is delivered. He is wonderfully converted. And as he is seated there at Jesus' feet, the townspeople come running up. They see this man. They see the change. I mean, it's obvious. He's not screaming. He's not cutting himself. He's not attacking anybody. He's sitting quietly listening to Jesus teach, and the pig keepers start telling the story again. I'm sure they went through town telling everybody about it, and then the crowd is there and they're looking and saying, "See, look! That was the crazy man. Look at him. And they begin to tell it all over again. Look, there's a cliff. There's where the pigs jumped off." And they're recounting this whole story. And the people from town hear the testimony of this great thing that Jesus has done. And how do they respond? I mean, unthinkable. In verse 17, they began to beg him to depart out of their coast. I don't even understand this. I mean, honestly, I've tried to get my mind around this. I don't get this at all. They see this and say, "Leave. This is too much turmoil for us. We can't handle this. You're messing with our lives. These are some strange stuff happening. We don't want to deal with this. Go away." An incredible response. They don't even ask him who he is. I mean, Luke 8 tells us that they responded this way. They took up this cry. In fact, it says to Luke 8, the whole multitude took up this cry because they were held by great fear. In fact, Mark 4, when the disciples saw Jesus calm the storm, it says they feared a great, mighty fear. It's the same kind of fear that's being described here of these multitudes, but the multitudes don't even ask, "Who is this?" The disciples, in their fear, they looked at Jesus and said, "What kind of man is this?" They at least looked at Jesus and said, "Who is this? What have we got ourselves into? Who are we dealing with? These townspeople don't even seem to ask that. They just say, go away. They were terrified, and they wanted the source of their fear gone. Instead of considering the deliverance point brought to this poor, afflicted man, and instead of considering the awesome power displayed by Jesus, they were held tight in the bonds of fear, and they just wanted to be left alone. They just wanted to be left alone. That really is, I think, what it gets down to again. The same response as that as the demons gave. They don't want deliverance. They don't want the presence of God. They don't want the power of Christ on display. They just want to be left alone. They just want things to go back to normal as quickly as possible. And their response is a fearful, faithless response. It's a tragic response. And yet at the same time, it's a common response. It really just, as we saw in Mark 4 again, the parables of the soil, so many, the seed falls on the hard ground and it just lays there and has no impact. It doesn't, the person that hears it is completely unaffected. These townspeople, they see it. They see this great thing. They see Jesus teaching him, and had they wanted to, they could have learned of who Jesus is, but they're unmoved. The only thing they want is to go back to normal. They're terrified that this guy's going to remain. And all they want is things to go back to what it was. But this man that was possessed with the demon, this man that was controlled by the legion, he responded with faith. He knew what had been done in him, and he loved Jesus for it. And the posture here is very telling. As he is sitting, he's clothed, he's in his right mind. It calls to mind the disciple just sitting at Jesus' feet to learn. And this man, he sees what has happened, and he's not terrified. He knows what Christ has done in him. He's known the mercy of God. He's trusting him. He's made himself a disciple of Christ, sitting and learning from him. And his response to Christ was one of great love and great trust. And as we look at this and we see again the great power of Jesus, there's a point, and a legitimate point, where it should, as it did in the disciples, stir in us a fear, and even a great fear. As Jesus has every right and every ability to do all that he desires, he has every right and every ability to cast every man immediately into hell. He has all the power to destroy this entire universe and consign every human to eternal suffering. And there's nothing we could ever do to stop him. There's no argument we could make that could turn Jesus aside were he to come right now in power and in judgment. There is real reason to quake and tremble before the awesome power, holiness, and wrath of God. And we cannot lose sight of that. We have a loving God. But we must also remember we have a holy, majestic, powerful God who does do all that he desires. However, we do well, as this man did, to trust his mercy. We do not have a capricious, thoughtless God. We do not have an unconcerned, unmoved God. We have a compassionate, loving, gracious, merciful God. And the result of such fear should drive us to submissive faith, not a rebellion, not neglect, not apathy. But we flee to his throne, we plead for his pardon, we cry out to him for his grace to deliver us. And had these town folks understood what they had, what they were dealing with, who was before them, had they understood, they would have known that his coming was in mercy and forgiveness, and they would have worshipped him as their Savior. This is the glory of this power of God. It is extended right now in mercy and in grace. God has stayed his hand of wrath, and he's extended his hand of mercy and of grace. He's extended pardon, and he's extended it with great patience. So that Peter tells us, as he describes the day of the Lord, when he will come in judgment. And it seems as if that judgment is long delayed. Peter tells us that God is not, he's not slack. He's not lazy regarding his promises. He will keep his promises, including the ones to come and bring judgment. He's not disregarding that promise, but he is patient. He is long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And we see in the power of God, we see the infinite mercy of God, that we can flee to it and there find pardon, find forgiveness, find restoration to him, find full fellowship, so that those who are separated from God, those who are far removed from him, those that are bound in sin, those that are enslaved to all manner of wickedness, even if it be a legion of wickedness, find in Christ full, complete pardon and reconciliation to the Father. This is the glorious promise of the power of Christ. And the story here concludes, and I'll wrap this up briefly here. With Jesus, he's returning in it to a ship. Verse 18, when he was come into the ship, it pictures it as Jesus is stepping into the boat. This man comes to Jesus and begs to go back with him. Jesus told him no. Verse 19, instead he said, go home to your friends and tell them how great things the Lord had done for thee and hath had compassion on thee. And so this man departed. And he began to publish in Decapolis. That's 10 Roman cities that were right there in that region. It was, the whole area there was called Decapolis. Began to publish in these 10 cities how great things Jesus had done for him. And all men did marvel. This man goes out. He desires to stay with Jesus, and Jesus sends him on a greater commission. He tells him, go out and tell his friends. This man tells his friends. He tells everybody around him. He goes into, leaves his town to go into these other cities around and tells everybody there. So the whole region knows and marvels at the compassion of the Lord. And the natural response here, the natural response of those that come to Christ is that of going and telling others. Telling others about his great compassion. Telling others of the great work of deliverance that he has done. So as we think about it this morning, as we think of this whole account, and it's so much here, the first question is we have to answer is, what are we going to do with Jesus? Are you going to respond in fear or in apathy? Or are you going to trust him? You that trust him, are you going to tell others of him? Are you going to declare his compassion and his power to all around you?